This is Captain Rick reporting. I'll be reading from the Wednesday, March 22nd edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. The first article is entitled, Council Candidates Weigh In on Gleason's Performance. Decatur. Andrew Apel, or Apel, A-P-E-L, one of six candidates for three spots on the Decatur City Council, has called for an investigation and vote on whether to fire City Manager Tim Gleason. In a statement issued Tuesday, Appel criticized Gleason's use of a police officer and driver to take him to the St. Louis airport after a city event in May 2015. The matter came to light during a lawsuit filed by former police chief Brad Sweeney last year, alleging that he was fired wrongfully by Gleason. Decatur deserves honest and ethical leadership, Appel said, after speaking to business owners and residents of Decatur. It is clear that immediate dissatisfaction exists, an immense dissatisfaction, and people want allegations of improperly investigated impropriety and the city manager held accountable. Appel said the impression has been left that questions have gone unanswered. He said an investigation and meeting of the full council would help to clear up any lingering issues. A council meeting on the matter, even in closed session, has not occurred, Appel said. Instead, he said Gleason met one-on-one with council members. We need to answer the questions, Appel said. I would not have a problem working with Gleason, but it's important we not leave the residents of Decatur in the dark. Gleason released a statement in response, reiterating earlier comments that former Mayor Mike McElroy told him the matter was official city business and arranged the use of the police car. McElroy died in July 2015. In July 2016, a special prosecutor for the state's attorney's appellate prosecutor's office declined to file charges after investigating the allegations of wrongdoing connected to the police car ride. When do I defend myself? I've been asked by many to do so and have been satisfied with the overwhelming support I receive from many in the community, to include strangers, Gleason said Tuesday. I often am speechless and will simply say thank you. It means so much and is what drives me to do even more for Decatur. The lies and rehashing of old news is not going to change that. I refuse. The old saying is true. The high road does prevail. Gleason's performance has already become an issue in the mayoral campaign. Incumbent Julie Wolf Moore has been supportive of the city manager, saying that he has been blamed for many problems he inherited. Challenger John Phillips has criticized some of Gleason's decisions, but said he needed better guidance from the mayor. Councilman Bill Faber endorsed Phillips in a paid column that appeared in the March 8th Decatur Tribune Weekly magazine. He said three things are needed to bring change to Decatur: a new plan, a new direction, and a new city manager. Comments that caused stir among his fellow council members. Other candidates in the council race include incumbent Pat McDonald, Chris Riley, Chuck Kuhl, David Horn, and Marty Watkins. McDaniel, who was supportive of hiring Gleason in 2015, said the city manager has been good at presenting information to the council and going back to the drawing board when changes are needed. McDaniel said part of his responsibility is to ask questions of the staff and other council members, which he has done but is not what he considers micromanaging. McDaniel said he would work with either of the candidates who has elected him as mayor. I will vigorously challenge any council member who attempts to micromanage the city staff, McDaniel said. Despite what some say, a city manager reports to all council members, not the other way around. And if all that would change, immediate actions will be taken. Riley said Gleason and Wolf Moore are taking care of the city's business, helping to set it on a path to address issues such as infrastructure needs. Riley is supportive of the job performance he's seen from Gleason. Decatur has been through situations where the city council didn't work well together, Riley said. He doesn't want that to happen again. I see no reason that should change, Riley said. Riley, who has been a Decatur Park Board commissioner for 16 years, said the city's relationship with the Park District has improved, starting with McElroy and former city manager Ryan McCready. It has continued to flourish with the current mayor and Gleason, Riley said. I know what used to be. I see no reason to reverse that trend. Cool said Gleason has made some tough decisions for the city, and, if elected, he would not try to micromanage the city manager. I believe in the form of government we have, Cool said. I like what I see. Cool isn't running because he's mad at anybody. I'm trying to look forward, Cool said. I want to contribute to the growth of Decatur. Horn said he didn't want to specifically discuss Gleason's job performance. As a candidate for Decatur City Council, it is inappropriate for me to comment on any personnel issues regarding the city manager, Horn said. Horn wants to create a strategic plan for moving the community forward. I see the role of a city council member as being a trustee for our city that helps implement a shared vision for its citizens, Horn said. No city is defined by a single individual, and it is only by working together that we will be able to overcome challenges our city faces and capitalize on our successes. Watkins wants more time to get to know Gleason. The city manager would be evaluated each year, which is the time Watkins said council members should express their concerns about his performance. Watkins said Gleason appeared to have his hands full after he arrived in Decatur. Watkins wants for the community to be able to move on and said that any apology from Gleason would be helpful. I feel the best is yet to come for the community, Watkins said. Let's move forward. Additionally, Appel said the city hit bar owners with audits after they raised concerns about increasing the cost of liquor license fees. The formulas are unfair to bars, said Appel, who previously was involved with running Cafe Brio's and Jabroni's. The fees hit you all at once. Why not keep them the same while times are tough? Appel said Decatur is a competitive market for bars, which must try to keep prices in line with other businesses in town. In the statement, Gleason said food and beverage audits are not retaliatory and often do not produce findings. In fact, most bar and restaurant owners have not had an issue with our audits because they have done nothing wrong, he said. But we have had some establishments underreporting their collections, many of whom have complained, which is not fair to those who choose to do the right thing. The next article is entitled, Macon County Awaits State Action on Eminent Domain Authority. Decatur. Patience is the watchword for Macon County officials as they await quick take eminent domain authority from the state for the Macon County Beltway project. The plan, approved unanimously by the county board during its March 9th meeting, would allow the county to acquire 8.3 acres of land just south of Brush College Road and Illinois 48 through eminent domain. Once in possession of the land, the county would start on a connector project that would be the starting point for the long-discussed beltway. This is the first step of many steps, and it needs to be done first, Macon County engineer Bruce Bird said. It's the key that opens the door to do the rest of the work. The plan needs approval from the General Assembly and Governor Bruce Rauner. If the authority is approved, the county will have 1 year to exercise its eminent domain right. So far, local lawmakers express support for the overall Beltway project, though one state representative has been less than supportive of the process. State Senator Andy Menar, Democrat Bunker Hill, said he plans to sponsor a bill in the Senate to give Macon County the authority after speaking with representatives from the city and the county about the importance of getting the Beltway project started. There are any number of reasons why this street makes complete economic sense for the city and county, Menar said. Even with his support, Menar said the preference is still for the county and the landowner to come to an agreement without the need for eminent domain. With the bill, which has not been filed as of Tuesday afternoon, Menar has said he is hopeful that the county can talk with all lawmakers and gather support for them before the plan moves forward in the General Assembly. County board members expressed concern during their March 9th meeting that several state lawmakers, including State Representative Bill Mitchell, Republican Forsyth, and State Representative Chapin Rose, Republican Mahomet, would oppose granting quick take authority. Rose expressed surprise when told of the comments from county officials, saying he has had good conversations with those in the city about the Beltway and what needs to be done. I've been supportive of the project, he said. Mitchell, while expressing support for the Beltway project, said he is troubled by the quick-take option. Mitchell said he thinks the proceedings have been rushed, adding that more negotiation should have taken place before the county asked for eminent domain authority. The county is acting like a bully here, Mitchell said. Just because they can do something does not mean they should. This is something you go to as a last resort, not a first resort. One particular issue that Mitchell raised was that the first bill to grant Macon County the authority was filed February 10th by Representative Jay Hoffman, a Democrat from Belleville in the Metro East area. His district is more than 100 miles from where the connector location is. I've been here a long time, and this is the first time I've seen something like this, Mitchell said. House Bill 3837 has been sent to the House Executive Committee. Hoffman did not respond to a request for comment left at his Springfield office. When told of Mitchell's comments, Byrd and Macon County Board Chairman Jay Dunn said the county has followed standard procedure regarding negotiations to obtain land for roads. In an email, Byrd said the plan to build the connector in that area was first presented during a public meeting in 2012, and the landowners were contacted in January for permission to survey the property. The county made its first contact with landowners about negotiations on January 10th, with an offer of $17,000 an acre presented 2 days later. The figure was based on an appraisal completed last fall, for which the county contracted with Springfield-based Hansen Engineering, with the appraisal completed by Joseph M. Webster of Webster and Associates. As of Tuesday afternoon, Byrd said the county has not received any counteroffer or an update on negotiations from either the landowners or their legal representation. We intend to negotiate, but it's kind of hard to dance when you don't have a partner, Byrd said. County officials say they have been negotiating with landowners Craig and Jill Wynn, who did not respond to a message left at their residence. An attorney said to be representing the landowners, Springfield-based Edward D. McNamara, has also did not respond to a request for comment. Part of the reason the county had sought the authority is due to concerns that money for the project could soon disappear. The cost to develop the intersection is covered by a $10 million investment given to the county in 2014 by former Governor Pat Quinn. Since not all of the money has not been used, Dunn said he's heard it is possible that the Illinois State of Transportation will take it away. Mitchell scoffed at that notion, saying he has spoken to representatives from DOT and Rauner's office who have promised him money for the project will not be touched. Byrd and Dunn stressed that the plan as of now is to continue a negotiated settlement with any eminent domain authority being an absolute last resort. I'm sure we can reach an agreement with the landowners. I think it's just a matter of getting together, Byrd said. The next article is entitled, Buyouts Relieve Richland Budget Stress, Decatur. A total of 16 full-time employees at Richland Community College have accepted buyouts as the college looks for ways to offset declining revenue. Those who accepted buyouts include 3 administrative staff, 2 faculty members, and 11 support staff, according to a presentation made during Tuesday night's meeting of the College Board of Trustees. These employees will leave their positions no later than June 30th. "We have had a good turnout for those interested in this," said Greg Florian, Vice President of Finance and Administration. "We're not there yet regarding budget, but this is a good start. With the buyouts, the college will be able to reduce its salary budget line by $848,478. The college will have to spend $281,241 to pay for incentives tied to the buyouts. The remaining savings of $567,237 will likely be reduced by an analysis to determine whether current employees or new hires will be required to perform the functions being performed by departing staff. We're still looking at what the net savings will be for the institution," Florian said. "Classes should go on as normal, despite the buyouts, as officials said it was a priority to make sure the spring semester would be unaffected. The buyouts were offered through a voluntary separation incentive plan, which stopped accepting applicants on Monday afternoon. Those who accepted buyouts will receive an incentive payment with the weekly amount equal to their base salary as of February 1st, divided by 52. Those employees will receive one weekly pay amount for each year of full-time employment up to 26 weeks. Of Richland's 156 full-time employees, 104 were eligible for the program. That includes 60 staffers and 44 faculty members. The cause for the cuts and buyouts is a combination of the school experiencing a 13% decline in enrollment over the past 6 years and a loss of funds from the state, which used to account for roughly 13% of the college's budget. The buyouts come several months after five administrative positions at the college were eliminated, including the Chief of Staff, Vice President of Economic Development and Innovative Workforce Solutions, and Director of Human Resources. Board members got a reminder of how shaky the financial situation is when College President Chris Valdez provided a PowerPoint presentation looking at the college's finance and early budget projections for the coming school year. Enrollment at Richland is at a 20-year low, which Valdez attributed to factors such as declining local population and a general enrollment decline among Illinois community colleges. Along with the buyouts with a tuition increase approved by the board last month, Valdez said the college must rebalance its budget and get more in line with similar-sized community colleges. The next article is entitled, "Museum Wakes from Hibernation. Macon County History Museum Gets Refresher Under Pierce." Decatur. When Nathan Pierce became the director of the Macon County History Museum in October 2013, he quickly realized the project that was ahead of him. There was a lot to like about the museum. Some well-crafted exhibits, a mural depicting American Indian life, and, of course, the original log cabin courthouse that Abraham Lincoln helped build and where he practiced law as part of the circuit court. But there were much-needed updates and renovations with very little help in the way of manpower or money. For three straight winters, the museum has closed this year until Monday, March 21st, while Pierce, a retired contractor, and a couple of volunteers help paint, hang material board panels, change and update some exhibits, clean out the archives and collections rooms, and also update the Prairie Village in the back of the museum, which includes the old courthouse. It's been a lot of construction and making it look better inside the museum and in the Prairie Village, Pierce said. And there's been a lot the public doesn't see, like the collections and the archives work. It's not like we have a big crew out here doing this either. In his first year, some of the lower part of much of the upstairs of the museum was painted, and the Lincoln Room was renovated. Last year was dedicated to the collections and archives rooms. Pierce said he'll always want to do updates and renovations as long as he's director, but that the biggest projects are now out of the way, and he likely won't have to close next winter. At this point, everything we need to close down to do has been done, Pierce said. The winter is the ideal time to close down if you have to, but it's not something we want to continue. Pierce said the museum has drawn about 4,000 visitors a year in his time there, but he's hoping to push that number up with no more closings for renovation and a fresh look. It looks a lot more appealing when you come out here now, Pierce said. Basically, almost all of the inside of the museum has been changed and overhauled. If you haven't been out here for a few years, it's going to be a lot different. The most recent renovations were mostly painting and hanging material board panels on the walls of the lower museum. The material boards, now featured all over the museum, allow for versatility if Pierce wants to change or move a display or exhibit. The Decatur Area Arts Council had them on their wall, and I started thinking that would be a good idea for us, Pierce said. The panels don't show nail holes, so they don't look worn out if you want to move them, and they look more professional. But we just had a lot of photos Velcroed to the wall. In addition to updating the railroad exhibit in the lower museum with some old signs that light up, Museum Board President Karen Anderson put together a 1920s exhibit. It includes period clothing and other items. Its theme is a 1920s storefront, Pierce said. Much of the clothes in the 1920s exhibit have been rediscovered in the archives and collections rooms. During the most recent break, Pierce and Anderson continued to organize the archives and collections, though much of the work done in those rooms came during last year's renovations. You literally couldn't walk in the collections rooms, Pierce said. There's a lot to do in there, but it's at least functioning. In the Prairie Village, every building has had some work done on it in Pierce's time as director. In the immediate future, the museum will host Prairie Life Days. Third graders take a visit to the museum May 3rd to the 5th, and Pierce hopes to have an exhibit on local sports finished soon. It's already started the lower museum, where there are several photos and some old wooden bats used by the Decatur Commodores baseball team. I'll be back with part two after the break.